Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That welcome was from our founder, Brian Brown. You are listening to the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less. It is Tuesday, December 15th, 2020, and we have six Brieflies gathered this morning via Zoom to discuss our place in the universe 1 week before we in the Northern Hemisphere begin our trek back toward the light. Winter solstice falls on this coming Monday, the 21st of December. I'll be celebrating not only our return voyage around the sun, but our metaphorical emergence from the dark of this past year. Congratulations to President-elect Joe Biden and a hearty, it's about time, salutations to our first woman VP, Kamala Harris. I'm Gail Kellner, your host for this week's program. Truman O'Brien, former airline pilot, is at the controls this morning in the Gene Bosch studios of Voice of Vachon. He has safely launched us into the air for a 45-minute flight over the political and cultural landscape of the United States. What do you hear from your Republican connections in West Texas?
Well, you know, the West Texans are being pretty quiet. Some of my folks in Alabama and New Jersey are being a bit rowdy. They definitely think that the Dems cheated on this thing, you know. I mean, they're reading Trump's, they're taking his line, hook, line, and sinker. So I find it pretty interesting myself. But anyway.
What do you hear from, is it Alabama, you said?
Yeah, Alabama and New Jersey. Yeah.
And New Jersey.
Yeah.
And they are believing the Trump line that the election was actually rigged.
The Dems stole it, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep, that's according to them.
Yeah, very interesting.
Very interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Yesterday, the Biden-Harris team left another hurdle in the race to inauguration, easily vaulting over the 270 electoral votes needed to secure the election. Protesters on both sides of this national tug of war made their presence known, and some state capitals closed their doors to the public for security reasons as the Electoral College cast their votes. We are joined this morning by historian Bruce Hallman, fondly known here at the Briefly as the Guardian of the Galaxy. Bruce, how do you get into the Electoral College? And what are you qualified to do upon graduation? Give us a brief but informative history and explanation of e-college.
The Electoral College education is not exactly what you get a degree for. Electoral College is, not to be too long-winded, but the Electoral College is an interesting artifact of sort of the founding of the Constitution when democracy was viewed as something to be kept out of the hands of the people. So originally, senators were elected by state legislators, not by the public, you know. And the Electoral College is just one of those mechanisms to sort of remove direct election from the people into sort of the elites. And that's one of the basic tenets of the original Constitution. Of course, most of those things have been changed, except for the Electoral College. To get to be an electoral, you just need to be, you know, one of the flackeys of the particular political party that wins your state. And so, you know, each state, really, when you're voting for president, you're not voting for president, you're voting for a slate of electors. So when we get our ballot in Washington State and it says Joe Biden or Donald Trump or, you know, Jill Green or whatever, you're not really voting for them, you're voting for 12 electors who say they will vote for that person. And there's been cases where there's been unfaithful electors, where electors have not voted the way that their state voted. That did not happen at all this election. You know, there were no unfaithful electors this time. But the Electoral College is one of those remnants of a concept of democracy and republican government that has largely faded away, except for the Electoral College. And it's one of the things that probably should be replaced by direct election of the president, rather than this sort of archaic sort of taking it out of the hands of the people and creating this barrier between direct election and actual election.
We've twice in recent history had the popular vote go one way and the Electoral College go the other.
Sure. Yep. Yeah. And it's happened in the past as well. It's not usual, but it can happen, particularly in close elections. And then particularly in the election of 1884, that sort of the deal was to swing to recognize the electors from the southern states that swung to the Republican nominee and ended Reconstruction.
Lynn, what share with us?
Just going to add. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Let me just add to what Bruce had to say. There's a pretty good article on the Electoral College in this morning's Seattle Times on page A5 that reiterates much of what Bruce said. And the thing that I got from that earlier history, Bruce, was trying to remember that back when the constitutional framers were trying to figure out what to do, there was not good educational systems anywhere. They really thought a vote by the people would be by uninformed masses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that has changed a lot over time.
Not necessarily.
Not to talk about judgment, but at least in terms of information, we've got a better system to inform people about their vote.
Go ahead, Kevin Jones.
Yes, I have. I just went back to like the very first for your consideration 4 years ago, and it was about the Hamilton electors and a statement. This is their statement about the value and the role of the Electoral College. So listen carefully and think about how it worked for us in 2016. Just your opinion. The process of the Electoral College affords a moral certainty that the office of the president will never fall to the lot of any man who is not in an eminent degree endowed with the prerequisite qualifications.
Wow. Yeah. That was some wishful thinking.
Guard against unqualified people entering up.
Oops.
Every system can be beat.
People have different opinions about qualifications, and we don't have a list, right? There's no checklist that I know of, but just, just consider the role and the value that it's providing to us today. So I think it's a good conversation to have.
Right. Very interesting. And also interesting to follow up on what you said, Lynn, that the uneducated masses, it was to protect against that. And Bruce, you mentioned this, I think, as well. And yet, in a certain way, one can make an argument that because our system of now obtaining news and information has become so convoluted and so partisan, that we actually have that very situation going on where, as Truman was sharing, many people around the country, I have actually read a majority of Republicans actually do believe that the vote, that there was fraudulent activity and the vote was stolen. And, you know, what do you do about something like that? It's very interesting to me. It makes me wonder if we don't need to have some kind of civics test. That has to be, I know we aren't supposed to have poll tests and things like that, but boy, some basic understanding and agreed upon information would be helpful. All right. Yeah. Michael Shook joins us.
Yeah. Just real quickly that I don't, even in the best of times, I don't really think that many people vote from a rational, a reasoned viewpoint where they sit down and, okay, boy, I've been reading about the candidates for a year. Now I've really examined closely so-and-so's view and so-and-so's view. And gosh, these policies seem like they're going to be much more productive for me and my community. I have rarely met anyone and very intelligent people who are well-informed about any number of things. But I just don't know that humans function that way. I think a lot of the time it just comes down to an emotional sort of instinct. I'm going to go with the person that appeals to my, you know, emotions or my fears the most. And that's a tactic that's worked for a long, long time, whether you're talking about the United States or any other country that has elections.
Yes, fear definitely has been used as a way to garner support. Lynn, I think you had something to say, and then Kevin. Go ahead.
I said my piece. I'm waiting till we get to the Atlanta portion to say my other piece.
Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
I'd like to reflect on the point that Michael's making, and it came very clearly to me through a process that Indivisible Vashon started about a year and a half ago now. And it was to talk about the attributes of presidential candidates. This was at a time when nobody knew who the nominee would be. We didn't even know at that time really who all the possible candidates were running for president. But we wanted to have a conversation about what were the attributes that really mattered, to have people think about this, and also to think about candidates that may capture their heart, but may not really have all of the other attributes to really make the office. And let's put our investment of time, energy, and passion into those who really could carry it off, right? And so the first session was, what are the attributes of a president, right? And of a presidential candidate, what are the things that we really need to measure here? And 80% of the items were about stature and confidence and ability to project a good message. So yeah, Michael, it's very much in the hearts of voters, even those who are studying and involved in groups like Indivisible, who think about this a lot. That is a very predominant force.
Yeah. Well, we are joined this morning also by Lynn Kerrigan, who we've heard from a little bit, former Georgia Peach, poet, provocateur, musician, feminist, and fighter for justice. Georgia just started its early vote for two seats that will decide control of the Senate. Lynn, do you have any predictions on the outcome of these races?
Well, what I did was actually contact my graduate school best friend, who still lives in Atlanta and is a social worker and a writer and an activist there. So I asked if he had any sense of the community and the feelings there about the race. I'm going to swing back to that in 1 second, because what I wanted to do was mention that there was a incredibly good article in the Sunday New York Times, December 13th, on page 27 of the Georgia Vote Transition in Washington, where they were actually talking about how Atlanta tore down its suburbs' political fences. Because you remember, I left just as white flight happened and the suburbs were completely Republican as Atlanta grew as a Black center of community there. And there were wonderful maps showing how in this article, all of the suburbs have slowly gone Democrat because of the increasing stature of the Black community in Atlanta, and more so because of a lot of influx of new voters, new people from other states, other countries. There's a big Latino and a big Asian community in Atlanta as well. So it's no longer so much a post-slavery economy. And it has always been sort of ruled in cycles where there's a very pragmatic connection to the Black community through the white business community. And that little balance has continued. And I was actually reading the article and pleased to see that it was informed by Andrea Young, who is the director of the ACLU in Georgia and is the daughter of Andrew Young, who was a very prominent early Black politician in Atlanta who I adored. But what I wanted to say that I thought was really interesting was what my friend Franklin said about the Senate runoffs. He said, "I am optimistic about the prospects of John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock winning the Georgia senatorial runoffs on January 5th. Joe Biden carried Georgia by 12,000 votes and our electorate is still excited about the possibility of these two wins. Both candidates are charismatic and have name recognition. Their opponents are rich crooks. Kelly Loeffler is an appointed senator with no natural constituency and is a Karen if ever there was one. David Perdue was caught red-handed in insider trading when he sold off stocks after a private Senate briefing on the coronavirus. Ossoff pummeled him so badly in their first debate, Perdue refused to face him in public again. Much of Georgia is very conservative, but we have a large Asian and Latinx immigrant populations in our cities and suburbs, and they are voting. And we have to thank the hugely effective organizing presidents of Stacey Abrams for the fact that Georgia is no longer a sure thing for Republicans.
Oh, thank you for that, Lynn.
We have it from the horse's mouth.
Any of the other briefly's like to weigh in with thoughts about the Senate race in Georgia? Kevin?
Well, I think that what you just cited, Lynn, goes again to the power of the people's integrity, and that it's not necessarily policy, facts, and data. I'm an engineer, believe me. That's the kind of stuff I like to look at. But yeah, what we're seeing now in this very post-truth, corruption-oriented administration we have now is that that integrity matters, and I think that that's playing out in Georgia as well.
Wouldn't that be lovely if that becomes something of the standard that we now look at when we look at politicians? That could be the upside once we get up through the muck.
We might see that begin to emerge. I think maybe we are seeing that. I'm hopeful for it. We saw the same thing after Watergate. People were so disenchanted with that there was a big swing a bit there. So hopefully.
Bruce. Well,
it's an interesting measure to me of the reasons why conservatives in the judiciary tend to be originalist, to go back to that constitutional model that limits access to votes and limits access to democracy, if you will, and why the Republican Party is so involved with gerrymandering and voter limitations and restrictions on access to votes. Because when votes become available to everybody, the Republican Party is not going to win anymore. And so it's a last desperate effort to maintain power. And it's an interesting process to watch. And Georgia will be the harbinger of what the future will bring.
Well, thank you for that. Lynn?
I just wanted to add one more thing. Kind of going back to what Michael was talking about, too, about people's emotional centers and emotional reactions to the most basic or obvious of facts. It's almost a Newtonian, to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. It seems that there is a huge dark web discussion happening about what will happen if the Senate is flipped and what will happen, in terms of Trump's last acts in office, about whatever can be done, should be done to ensure that Trump has another 4 years. And so here we have some people who have been incited to riot by their own president and who are not interested in facts and sort of these inescapable truths about the immigration changing our populations and our old order, especially in the South, which controlled politics for a long time because those Southern votes were needed. So I'm just, kind of stunned at, I'm glad, I'm happy, but at the lengths people are willing to go to believe what they want to believe and get the outcomes that they want. I hope it's not another scenario of barbarians in the gates, where people want to believe that might makes right and that if they say it enough, it will be true. The human brain is capable of divine, sublime thinking and also of the darkest, tragic, painful, grotesque, you know, debasements. So we will see how this election goes in the next few weeks.
I think that one thing that we're seeing play out is the power of leadership and our tendency in as a group to look to our leaders. And I think in this case, you know, Trump is very definitely playing every card he has and with results. And it's extremely, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? It's beyond disturbing. At any rate, it's extremely disturbing to see this happen and to have the president leading our way and leading so many people in this way. All right, let's go on. I'd like to welcome Kevin Jones. We've heard from him a few times this morning. Thank you. Kevin Jones does a modest Clark Kent impersonation by day, but dons as needed his cape, and he's our own superhero of activism. Tell us, Kevin, what is the most important things Biden-Harris supporters can do in the coming days before the inauguration?
Well, other than installing that phone booth for the quick changes it's Georgia, for one. Go to indivisiblevashon.org. Right at the top of the page, help get out the vote for the Georgia runoff elections. The most effective thing we can do to aid the president-elect and vice president-elect is give them a Congress that will work with them and support their policies. I've been doing a lot of texting into Georgia voters. The electorate is excited about what they're about to do. And join that. Easy, click on the top banner of the website, find a way to connect in Georgia.
Thanks for that, Kevin. I almost daily get requests for money and have been sending out my bits of it here and there towards those races. Do you think that helps?
Yes, I do. You know, there's like politics these days is driven by money, and it's a, you know, necessary evil. One of the first things you'll see on our Georgia page is organizations you can donate to. And we tend not to go there, but it is so important to help these candidates get the word out. Fair Fight, Stacey Abrams' organization, is one of the top groups on that list. If you have some money that you can spare, it is certainly for a good cause.
All right. Thank you for that. Last but never least, our brieflies are rounded out this morning by the presence of our own Michael Shook Carpenter, self-described as a half bubble shy of plum, and Renaissance man who reminds us all that it is the 250th anniversary of the birth of Beethoven. In Michael's words, arguably the greatest composer of symphonic music the world has yet seen. Michael, tell us a little about what we're about to hear.
Thank you, Gail. Yeah, well, it's everyone's heard it lots of times in commercials or movie themes or things like that. But this is just the snippet at the end of the fourth movement of the Ninth Symphony. And Beethoven set Friedrich Schiller's poem, Ode to Joy, to music and used that in it. Just a word about the Beethoven and people I've talked to at times have said, oh, classical music, it's just so everything. I don't want to listen to it. It's this, it's that, it's the other. But I would urge anyone who has never listened to classical music, find there's so much out there that is so accessible. And there are many smaller pieces. You don't have to start with the ninth. It's Beethoven's oeuvre there, because it's over an hour long.
We're only going to be playing a few minutes of it, right, Michael? Truman? <That's true. laughs>
And it's magnificent. And Beethoven was just the rest of us are mere mortals. But he also wrote many things. There's different little light piano pieces, bagatelles and things that are just exquisite. And you can casually listen to them you know, sitting back with your coffee or a martini or something in an easy chair and really enjoy it. It's kind of give you an entry into some of the broader works. So
we can kind of consider this a lovely intermission from our political conversation for a moment, a moment of peace and joy.
Yeah.
Ode to joy.
Well, now this is so.
Lovely. Michael, go ahead.
I was just going to throw in there that the words, the opening words to the poem, and I thought this is fits with the solstice and the election of Biden and Harris, and the words translated to English are joy, beautiful spark of divinity, daughter of Elysium. We enter your sanctuary, burning with fervor, O heavenly being. Your magic brings together what custom has sternly divided. All of us shall become brothers and sisters wherever your gentle wings hover.
Wow.
It's a magnificent.
Thank you, Renaissance Man, for bringing that moment of joy to us this morning.
So, Michael, what was the play? Was it Variations? No, what was it called?
Yeah, that was 33 variations.
33 variations, that was it.
And I desperately wanted to play Beethoven, but was actually given what I think was a better part. It was more fun. Of Anton Schindler, Beethoven's personal secretary for a couple of years. It was something of a kind of a shady character.
Yeah.
He wanted to help Beethoven, but he also wanted to he saw a way to earn some money and some. Yeah.
It was a wonderful play, and you were brilliant in it, by the way.
Well, thank you. It was loads of fun. And a final note, the VCA, Vashon Center for the Arts, has a celebration tomorrow. So you can go to their website, and I believe they have a concert that starts at 8. And they're part of a whole Beethoven celebration of arts organizations around Puget Sound and the whole country. So,
thank you for that, Michael. I'll be sure to tune in. Wonderful. Bruce,
lovely.
As the days begin to get longer and the light returns, what hurdles are still on the horizon for our fearless president-elect and his courageous colleague, Kamala Harris? Perhaps vote counting by the current vice president, a man impersonating a pencil, on January 6th? Any tasty tidbits of history still caught in the beards of past VPs?
Well, it's, you know... What will happen on January 6th hopefully will be procedural. And, you know, there's a possibility of, you know, if they can round up a senator to join some of the crazies in the House, there may be some challenges to electors. But I suspect that will not happen. And, you know, it'll be pretty much a procedural counting of the votes. But it's important not to discount the role of the president of the Senate. And a great example comes from our own House of Congress and our state legislature in Washington State, where the lieutenant governor sits as the president of the Senate. Back in the late 1950s, there was a vote, a very close vote in the Senate over a proposal to build a bridge to Vashon Island. And actually, it was the president of the Senate, the Lieutenant Governor John Sherberg, who cast the deciding vote to send the matter back to the committee, where everybody knew it would die because the committee was opposed to a bridge to Vashon. So his one vote, in effect, saved Vashon from becoming Mercer Island or Bainbridge Island or having a bridge to it, like islands all over the world have. So it's easy to sort of dismiss the role of vice president, but as president of the Senate, there are times when that deciding vote is significant, and Kamala Harris will make a great vice president and president of the Senate.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. That was fun. Go ahead, Kevin.
was, you know, just thinking about the recent jockeying and posturing of elected officials in high office who were talking about, you know, the election. And even today, I saw this morning when I flipped on the news that there's still like Lindsey Graham, others who are U.S. senators saying, well, you know, we're not really certain who's the president-elect yet. You know, we'll see. On Inauguration Day, somebody will be inaugurated. I'm hoping that Vice President Pence finds his inner John McCain. when John McCain was challenged by a voter during the primary and when he was running against Obama. And the voter said, Obama is a terrorist, not born in this country. And McCain said, no, ma'am, he's an American citizen, and we just happen to have a difference of opinion. We need their inner John McCains now, and I hope they find them.
Thank you for that, Kevin. Lynn.
That's right. The two things that I think are kind of wild cards coming up right now are, one, you know, Bill Barr, Attorney General, has just resigned since Trump went on the attack against him for not supporting Trump further in his claims about fraud. And so there will be a new Attorney General appointed, I'm assuming, who will be even probably more of a lackey than Barr was. Which I think is disturbing. And in the light of my second issue, which is kind of the breaking news of Russians hacking again into the, not electoral databases, but into state agencies or federal agencies, I think that can be, you know, it's an unknown. We don't know how it will turn out. We don't know kind of the extent of it. We don't know how it will be used to tarnish election results, but I think those are wild cards, you know, that are kind of breaking news between now and January 20th.
I thought it was interesting that Putin congratulated Biden in the last day or so, as well as Mitch McConnell. So I think those are two figures that loom large. Anyone else have any thoughts about that? Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, the cynic in me is wondering how many elected Republicans like Lindsey Graham are now going to follow the lead of Vladimir Putin. But maybe we shouldn't go there. the whole notion behind...
That's a great irony.
Exactly. The whole notion behind Protect the Results, which was in many organizations... got together around making sure that activities to derail the electoral process don't happen, and that we proceed, even though there, you know, there's a lot of guardrails in place, and in some cases, few actual laws, but they were there to raise the voice, and it does just center us that democracy is really an opinion about how we all feel about how we interpret these laws and these policies. Voices like McConnell. And others of that stature, I think, add to the high likelihood that we're going to proceed on January 6th without too much turmoil. But I do differ with that. I'm almost positive in my mind that there will be some challenges. I think it may be like the Texas challenge to the Supreme Court to throw out the votes of four states, and I suspect those will go down pretty fast. But we'll see. You know, it's getting great theater.
Yes. Go ahead, Bruce.
Well, it's great theater, but Friday, wait for the report from the National Security Advisor to the President. Executive Order 13848, which was signed 2 years ago by Trump, requires a report from the National Security Advisor on 45 days after the election, which is this Friday. About whether or not there was foreign interference with the election. And if the National Security Advisor declares that there was foreign interference, then it opens the door for Trump to move in all kinds of directions to declare the election invalid, to invoke the Insurrection Act, to declare martial law. I mean, these are way out, far out, sort of right-wing things, but they're being talked about on right-wing conspiracy sites. And so if Trump is listening to those folks, he could possibly see a way out of losing the White House and ending up in prison. So I put nothing by this president. I mean, he's shown that he's willing to do almost anything to stay in power. And he's used up all his legal mechanisms at this point. So it's a really very cautionary tale that he may move into these still legal because Executive Order 18484 is in place. And if it's decided that the election was interfered with, it opens up all kinds of avenues for the president to move in ways to rectify that and ensure that the election was indeed a fair election, not a not an unfair election. So again, wow. Right-wing sort of fringe sort of attitudes, but there are a lot of important right-wing people who are talking that scenario right now. And I suspect Trump is hearing that.
Go ahead, Michael, and then Lynn.
Yeah, that is... that is disturbing. Andrew Coburn wrote a piece that explored that in some of these issues in detail in the last month's Harper's Magazine. If anybody wants to go to the library and look that up, it's pretty disturbing the myriad ways in which the president can overthrow the will of the people. And all by legal means, as you say, Bruce. I wonder, it had kind of gone off my radar, and I kept thinking, oh, geez, you know, Trump is just flailing here. He keeps sending out all these tweets every day. You know, he's slowed down a little bit, I guess because he can't hit the golf ball and tweet at the same time, but he's still sending them out. And now it just occurred to me, I wonder if he's kept that up so that when, as you say, Bruce, Friday arrives, you know, he's sort of kept the momentum going and he can say, yeah, you see, I was right. It's all been corrupted. Now I have to do my thing.
And to think I was about to give up drinking. Go ahead, Lynn.
Don't do that.
Well, you know, I caught George Conway, who was one of the founders of the Lincoln Project, the disaffected Republicans who were anti-Trump. He was on BBC World News on Sunday night and really had quite a damning, if I can say that, opinion of Trump, that he kind of called him out for being a liar and a narcissist and you know, malevolent. And it made me think, boy, I bet impeachment looks pretty good now again. You know, I just don't understand how anybody can allow the lack of oversight that enables somebody like Trump to be so abusive of the presidential power and tilt us toward, you know, fascism or at least an authoritarian type state. It's just mind-boggling to me that it's not evident to everybody that he is not a well person mentally, and that, you know, here we have a crazy person running the country and people going along with it. This will not end well unless, you know, all the progressive, you know, rational people sort of really stand together and say, please, no. You know, we need to stop this, nip it in the bud. And that's what I am hopeful about this election, that we'll do that. But it's pretty shocking to think that 74 million people bought what he's selling.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, and I, you know, that is in some ways, it depends on how you look at that number, 74 million. It is disturbing in one sense, but for an awful lot of those 74 million people, he was looking like a pretty good alternative. I think it's dangerous to just dismiss folks as being uninformed or, and I'm not sure if that's what you did there, but that's what I've heard a lot, is that how could they be duped that way? And as far back as the mid 60s, Eric Hoffer was already writing about the coming gutting of manufacturing base and the displacement of jobs. And he said, when you take a large portion of the population and you suddenly strip them of the means that they have to earn a job, earn a living for themselves and their families, and to support their communities, and to do that with some dignity, when that is jerked away, now you've got a significant portion of the population that is angry, frustrated, restless, and devoid, you know, they've bereft of their livelihoods. And those people are ripe for someone to come in and make promises. And this is where, to me, I think the Democratic Party has really fallen on its face. That was the moment to step in and try to do something productive to help those parts of the country make an economic comeback, because it just comes down to that so much of the time. Can I pay my mortgage? Can I get my kid new clothes for school this year? Can I take even a week off this year and enjoy some time with my family? And if I can't, I'm going to look for somebody who's going to promise me that.
Right. I think that's the thing. It's kind of a false idol kind of thing with Trump. He made lots of promises, lots of pointing fingers, when, at least from a Democratic perspective, we see the problems not lying with immigrants or people of color or these things that Trump seems to target. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, I completely agree. And to Michael, to amplify the point, you know, I've talked to a lot of.
You're muted.
Kevin, you're just muted.
Kevin's muted for a moment. There he is. He's back.
Click the right button. Thank you so much.
Yeah, go ahead. Start again.
Yeah, I agree, Gail and Michael. I wanted just to the point that you made, I'd like to amplify. I've been talking to not only local, but a few, our national coordinator of Indivisible, about where does Indivisible go in the next 2 years, right? Our major objective to move to a more enlightened administration appears to now have been achieved. And the notion of addressing misinformation and disinformation, which we talked about at the top of the show, is one of those things. And how can independent radio and other voices sort of provide a narrative that differs from what so many people do hear about how we're not being served by our government and we need to blow it up. But also the idea of building community strength and resilience and sustainability, which is just not only goes across, you know, different cultural communities, but also different communities that have been hurt. You know, one polling indicates that progressive principles and values and policies resonate really well with the populace. You know, take gun safety. Most gun owners believe that we should have background checks and make sure that guns are being owned by responsible people. That makes perfect sense. Most people believe with that, but they don't tend to move in that direction. And part of it, this theory, is that we just need to be able to clearly state not only how these policies really enrich people's lives, but also deliver on that promise. And so, but it starts, I think, with stories about how this policy can be more helpful to you. It's complicated maps, but that's where I think the focus needs to be in the next couple of years.
Thanks, Kevin. Well, it looks like we're at the end of our time nearly, but I'd like to end on a final note of good news. One Arctic drilling and extraction project was halted. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit rejected the Trump administration approval of an offshore drilling project in the Arctic waters. So chalk one up for the polar bears and for all of those who, all the good work out there. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Wonderful, wonderful show today.